Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Bob Kramer, a nationally recognized authority on aging and senior living. Bob is the co-founder of NIC, the National Investment Center for Seniors Housing and Care, and the founder of Nexus Insights, a think tank working to advance bold ideas and disruptive models that support aging well. Bob has been called a disruptive force in the field, always challenging us to think differently about aging, housing, and care. Bob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Derek. I'm delighted to join you and look forward to our conversation.
Well, I've admired you for quite some time and have really been looking forward to this conversation as well. So through our conversation and you know what we've discussed, I know one of your key goals is to challenge outdated and often harmful narratives around aging. What are some of the biggest misconceptions that Americans have about aging, in your opinion?
I think first and foremost, and this has really come about sort of since World War II and really with the boomers, and that is aging is bad. Aging is something to be feared. Aging is something negative. And I could go on. But I think, and what I've done to sort of counter that is to point out particularly, because I spend a lot of time teaching in college and university campuses, is that aging is prejudice against our future selves. And to get young people in particular, like I will start, Derek, now my classes, and I will ask everyone to write down what age they think they will live to. And then I'll have some of the students share. And then I'll put up my first slide, which shows the average college student today and the average grad student today and what their life expectancy is. And what it shows is that over half of them in the classroom statistically will live to 100. And then I point out to them that if they don't work to change these ageist stereotypes, they will be consigned to social, economic, and cultural irrelevancy for the last third of their lives, making the point again that ageism is prejudice against our future selves. And then our course takes on a completely different discussion. Now it's relevant to them. I make the point contrary to what they start the course with. I say, look, at age 75, it's too late for me to change society attitudes that are going to affect my aging well. It's not too late for you. That's why you have more at stake in these issues as a college or grad student than I do as a 75-year-old. And it completely reverses their way of thinking.
So you know, as you've said, aging is deeply ingrained in our culture, but there's growing momentum around seeing aging as a time of value, not decline. Why is it so important to shift from an ageist to an asset-based view of older adults?
Well, I think for several reasons. One, older adults, we really now have a new stage of life, which increased longevity has made possible. My friend Joe Coughlin, who started and leads the MIT Age Lab, likes to talk about the next 8,000 days. There are 8,000 days from 0 to 22, 8,000 days from 22 to 44. You see where I'm going. 8,000 days from 44 to 68. Well, there, guess what? There are another 8,000 days from 66 to 88. And if you reach age 65, the average adult will have another 8,000 days ahead of them. That's a quarter of your life. That's a new stage of life. And older adults today are keys as contributors to many of the greatest challenges we have. Take one, workforce. The largest, with increasing deportations and decreasing immigration, the largest untapped workforce in America are older adults 55 to 80. And boy, do we need them. And if it's not paid work, it's also unpaid work. It says volunteers. You know, the greatest opportunity with regard to truly bending the cost curve and outcome curve in healthcare is with older adults. And another area, people talk about loneliness and issues of social isolation and loneliness. The age group with the highest incidence reported of loneliness are young people 18 to 29, far greater than those over 75. But we've seen exciting programs where older adults are paired with and work with younger adults 18 to 29 to address that epidemic of loneliness. It's not an epidemic among older people as much as it's an epidemic among young adults who, yes, they are our future. So I could go on, but again, you get the point. I can go through one social issue after another and show how older adults are going to be key. They're not the problem. They're a key to solving the problem, to addressing the problem.
Well said. Well said. Now, do you see a future in which a lot of the current ageist stereotypes have been eliminated?
I think it's probably naive to think eliminated, but I do think there's going to be a greater awareness of them, and there will be changes. For instance, you know, I this is a really old-fashioned phrase, but I love it. You know, in some ways, baby boomers, and I'm a leading age boomer born just after World War II, we are being hoisted on our own petard, which is a way of saying that no generational cohort, first of all, our sheer size, but we fell in love with staying young forever. And as a result, now that we're the ones on Social Security, we are being penalized for our own sense of glorifying being young forever, and therefore by correlation, making getting old a bad thing. And suddenly, we're the ones who are old. But do I see that changing? Yes. I see it changing now increasingly, I think, especially in today, 2025's setting. Employers have to realize one of the things they saw during COVID was they weren't prepared for the enormous brain drain when basically they encouraged people to retire early. And they had this enormous knowledge. Instead of a knowledge transfer, it was a knowledge loss. And so I think that from the workplace and employers to the recognition in healthcare in so many areas, older adults are now front and center. And I think that will change some attitudes. Will it eliminate ageism? No, it won't. But will it change some attitudes? Yes. So that's where I'm excited when I look, for instance, in Hollywood and in mass media and in film. You're beginning to see some positive presentations of older adults, whereas before it was every stereotype you could imagine. Another area would be because of a campaign by many people, including me, Hallmark is now changing its unbelievably ageist approach to birthdays and life transitions. And they now have pulled many of the worst of their greeting cards, which basically said, you know, when you turn 40, it's all downhill from here, which not only don't fit the reality of aging in America today, but are also, again, a really negative tone towards aging, where aging is defined by what you've lost. And again, in our American culture, for women, that's beauty. And for men, that's sexual virility. And those two things become defined as that's what defines getting old. There's a fascinating series now of videos and that AARP has released where young people are asked, what they consider to be the age of being old, and then how they believe older adults would walk across the street, would use a cell phone, so forth. And again, it's negative, it's stereotypical, and then they're introduced to older adults, and they're partnered with those older adults. And then after this, they ask those young people again, now what do you think is old? A huge shift. Now what do you think of old people? Huge shift. So again, intergenerational programs and programming. So I am encouraged by, I look at a film like Familiar Touch, which just was released in, opened in New York just a few weeks ago, and just this 2 weeks ago opened in LA and now in a number of other theaters. And for the first time, this film won Best Debut Film, Best Director, and Best Actress in the Venice Film Festival. But it's a film, it's a film about a woman with Alzheimer's, and who is moved by her son, whom she no longer recognizes, into the dementia care part of a senior living community. And it's an incredibly powerful film. It doesn't romanticize the realities, but at the same time, it points out there's an incredible humanness to this situation. And it's just such an emotionally engaging film. And the lead actor, Kathleen Chalfant, gives a masterful performance. You would never have seen a film like that, Derek, 5 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. And that encourages me.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there have been some, I think, amazing stories told over the years, but I'm really looking forward to seeing that one. And the AARP series you're referring to, I'll definitely be looking into that as well. So before launching Nexus Insights, which is your most recent venture, you co-founded the National Investment Center for Seniors Housing and Care, as we've already stated. You're widely regarded as a visionary in senior living. What trends are you seeing in how senior living is evolving in recent years?
Well, I think there are several key trends, and a number of which were really, I would say, accelerated by COVID. They weren't caused by COVID, but they were accelerated. Let me give you an example. I think the whole field of aging services, and specifically seniors housing and care, was really stuck in the 20th century with regard to digital technology and technology generally. And all that changed during COVID. And older adults and their adult children discovered on-demand services, discovered that anything could be delivered to you where you lived. So the idea of shipping you out for your healthcare, that was a commonplace perception and reality in 2019. 2025 doesn't cut it anymore. So I think trends I see, a more sophisticated and savvy consumer who is much more interested, not just simply in how many survival years they're going to have, but rather, will those be thrive years? In other words, they want, as I put it, they're not more just interested in adding years to their life. They want to make sure there's real life in those years. And so they're going to demand that wherever setting they're aging in, is it putting life into those years? Is it giving them more thrive years? Or is it just simply, we have the care you need when you or your spouse or most likely your adult children absolutely can't live any longer without it? Is it a setting that's defined by deficits and decline? Or is a setting defined by growth and engagement? So I think that a changing consumer who is much more savvy, is much more interested in not just lifespan, but health span, wealth span, and also wealth span. Secondly, the arrival of technology and digital technology and on-demand services. Thirdly, the expectation that healthcare will be integrated into the setting where you're living, but that it's not just end-of-life care, it's preventative, it's predictive, and it's participatory. It's preventative, meaning we want to help you before you have that UTI or before you have that fall. Or if you have a genetic disposition that makes you more likely to have Alzheimer's or some form of dementia, we now know there are lifestyle things you can do to delay that onset by 5 to 7 years. That's huge.
Really is remarkable what we're going to be able to do, you know, moving forward, given all of the, you know, the rapid advances.
So I think a changing consumer, savvy, more demanding, more focused on wealth span and health span. Secondly, a digital era where technology makes a huge, huge difference. Thirdly, the idea that, you know, you're not going to be shipped out for your healthcare, but that basically in a preventative and predictive way and also participatory. Ultimately, if one's going to have better quality of life, that isn't a pill you take or something that somebody does for you. It's really lifestyle changes, but they have to be tied to goals that are important to you. It's like New Year's resolutions. You know, they can come and go quickly. But if I say, well, what's an important goal? Well, I want to go to my grandson's graduation and I want to see him walk across the stage. Okay, well, what are we going to do in the next 9 months so that you're going to be able to achieve that goal? And that puts a due definition on why it's important for me. If just to be told you ought to work out, that's a fuzzy thing. And like all New Year's resolutions, last 4 weeks. But to be told, okay, there's no reason at 88 why you can't go to your grandson's graduation. But we're going to have a plan to get you there. And it's going to require, it's not just what we're going to do for you or to you. It's what we're going to enable you to do for yourself. And I think that's another shift in our field in the future years. We've been so focused on what we do to and for older adults that we actually at times have created what my friend and Nexus fellow Dr. Bill Thomas likes to call a culture of learned helplessness. And what that means is, you know, learned helplessness means we do everything for you. That's amenity rich, but actually, you know, it's like when suddenly you can always take an elevator, you no longer take steps. Well, there are times when taking steps is not a good thing for some people. For other people, it's important to keep taking steps because they retain the ability then to take steps.
Certainly, certainly. That's all great points. So you referenced a few different ways that care will be delivered mm-hmm. and different models, but what are some new models specifically that you think will define the next era of senior living or the next era of aging, wherever they might be aging?
Well, I think your last clarification is a good one. I think there are going to be so many older adults and many older adults needing support and encouragement and in terms of living a healthy lifestyle, that it's not going to be a matter of either or. It's going to be a matter of both and. What do I mean? We need more models to enable people to live safely longer at home. We also need more models with that for people to have community engagement without necessarily moving into a community. And lastly, we need communities, senior housing and care communities, where people feel I am not giving up my sense of independent agency and self-worth because now I'm just going to be cared for in the final years of my decline. So it's changing that image and that reality of that setting, but it's also realizing for some just for sheer economic reasons, for some lifestyle choice reasons. We need to, as I said, enable people to be able to live safely longer at home. And we also need, I think there's a perception that, for instance, senior centers and community centers, we may think of, well, I will never need that. The reality is we all need social interaction. And so creating those opportunities, and they may not be, they may be to coordinate volunteer activities. But in other words, the opportunities, and I saw wonderful examples of this during COVID, where residents, they couldn't go out for safety reasons, but enabling them to feel they could contribute. One organization in Palm Beach County in Florida basically did what they did was went through all the needs the nonprofit organizations had and then matched them up with older adults and in some instances with senior housing communities where they would be able to address some of those needs. And to me, that's an exciting model for the future. All of us, Derek, are wired. Part of the Japanese use the phrase ikigai, meaning literally reason to get up for my breakfast or purpose. We're all wired to need to have a purpose, which is defined as, in this sense, what I'm still can create value and contribute to other human beings. And I think that's the greatest shift that's going to take place in aging services is rather what are we doing for these deficit declining, decrepit older adults? It's rather how are we enabling them to contribute in ways we need them to contribute to our society?
Sure. Now, you know, the whole notion of person-centered care has been, mm-hmm. in our vernacular for, you know, a decade or more, the Pioneer Network and other fine organizations. Do you feel like we as a field are making headway? Are we making serious progress?
Yes and no. It's a mixed response there. I think the good news is, during COVID, for instance, we finally realized that our frontline staff, our hourly staff, they aren't producing widgets. And therefore, we can't say, you have six responsibilities during your shift. And as long as you do those, we have no interest in your life outside of your shift. Well, suddenly in COVID, we had to have an interest. How did they get to work? Who were they caring for at home? Where were they going shopping? All those became relevant to could they get to work and what exposure to COVID do they have outside of their work setting? Well, I think that's carried over in a good way. In senior housing and care and in aging services, we really have two customers. One customer is the older adult. The other customer is our staff. And if we don't treat them well, we can't expect them to do the right things by older adults. And so I do see some real shifts in that. Does it need to change further? Absolutely. And but I see some encouraging signs, but we have a long ways to go. And we just as we have a long ways to go, I see intergenerational programs. I see the Annenberg Center and other groups like that that are doing some pioneering cross-generational and multi-generational programming that really encourages me. But they're not the norm. They're still the exception. We need to make them the norm. And my hope is that over the next 10 years, they will become the norm, not the exception.
Great point. Yeah, I have been in contact and in conversation with the executive director at the Annenberg GenSpace out in Los Angeles, and it's a phenomenal program.
We need more of them. As I said, right now, they're a trailblazer. There are other groups like that, but again, Trent Stamp, the Eisner Foundation, and there's and you see that. I mean, Broadview, which is a life plan community on the grounds of Purchase College in New York, and it's not the only one. LaSalle Village on the grounds of LaSalle University in Massachusetts, but these are truly integrated programs. On the one hand, they are communities that serve older adults, but on the other hand, they're deeply enmeshed in the life of an ongoing college or university. And so it's ongoing learning, it's intergenerational programming, it's all of the things that I think are really exciting. And let's face it, for many of these colleges and universities, it's a new customer. It's a new resident base. It's a new use of some of their dorms and all of their infrastructure that they have. So exciting. Co-Generate, formerly Encore, founded by Mark Friedman and Eunice. I'm just drawing a blank. But the two of them, again, an exciting program. So again, these didn't exist 10 years ago. They exist today. That's encouraging. But they are still not the norm. And the fact that I can name most of the organizations, on the fingers on my hand says they're not the norm.
Yep, great point. So, you know, we do hear a lot of talk about the silver tsunami, which I know you take issue with that term. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. But is the current model, and as you said, there are some innovators, but the current model as we see it, is it sustainable for that incoming wave of boomers?
Yeah. No, it's not. put simply. The phrase silver tsunami reflects one of our biggest ageist problems. And that is, if you think about a tsunami, it's true that in many tragedies, there are some silver linings, but people never think of a tsunami as a positive thing. It's an unmitigated disaster. And so the phrase silver tsunami says that the increased longevity and the growing number of older adults in society is an unmitigated disaster for society. That, to my mind, is the complete wrong way of looking at it. Put another way, what I've written is, it's turning the longevity bonus into a longevity curse. And my work is all about how do we recognize the longevity bonus while recognizing at the same time that bonus is not equally experienced by all. So socioeconomic status, access to healthcare, genetic issues, there, and also there are many people who are counting the days till they retire because they're in dangerous professions or physically incredibly demanding professions. And I rejoice with them as they rejoice in their retirement. But my point would be, what's next? Not I'm finished, I'm done, but to think in terms of what's next for them. But the point is, the silver tsunami says that the aging of America is an unmitigated disaster. And how will we adjust to that? So it's the wrong paradigm. We have to think in a longevity economy, how do we turn increased longevity into a bonus for the individuals themselves and for our society at large? And that's what my work is very much focused on.
Sure. And we'll turn to Nexus in just a moment. But, you know, the aging services sector increasingly is under pressure to do more with less. Technology and data are often seen as part of the solution. How do you think technology and data fit into the future of aging services? You touched on it a little bit earlier in the conversation, but, you know, how would you really summarize that?
Well, first of all, I'd say that technology and data play an absolutely key role and in one sense transformative. That said, for instance, look at AI. AI is already doing and will do even more incredible things. But the last area where the jobs are going to be replaced is going to be in senior care. We are a high touch, but we have to also be high tech space. So the role of technology and of useful data is to, for instance, enable us to enable our staff to work to the limits of their license rather than to be overwhelmed with paperwork, to make sure that everyone that touches the life of that older adult has the information they need to basically, for instance, for, say in healthcare, to realize drug interactions, to realize that person's history, to be able to customize and personalize not only medical treatment, but ultimately their health plan overall. Before that, just simply sorting through all the data, let alone making it instantly accessible and actionable to all the people who might touch, that was an overwhelming task, and it required all kinds of new staff. Now we have this opportunity to what would have taken a staff person weeks, AI can do in 5 or 10 minutes. That's exciting. And that enables, that means that we have the ability to be predictive. This person, given all these factors, we know, all right, maybe you have, let's just say, for instance, you have, let's say you have 20 residents on your wing. AI can, it doesn't necessarily yet, offer you the opportunity every morning, real time, to not look back on last month and lessons to be learned, but to say, given all of their information as of right now, 7 a.m. shift start, of your 20 people, here are 3 people at high risk today that you need to spend the most time with. Here are another 3 people that are at moderate risk that you should be sure to check in with. And here are 14 others that should be the lowest on your priority list, because they're not high risk. And that immediately says to staff, okay, if I'm into fall prevention, these 3 high risk people, I need to be really focused on them. And another thing, you're not going to extend your 8-hour shift by an extra hour and a half because of paperwork. That's going to be huge. So does it, we can't move to value-based care. We can't move to providing more Thrive Years without technology and having actionable data. But it's actionable data, and it's having people make decisions on that. It's not going to be AI-generated robots providing that quality of life. It's going to be people.
Yep. Great points. I couldn't agree more. You know, this is such a high touch field. And I think, you know, the job security will be insulated from that. But given, as you've already shared, some of the workforce challenges of finding people, it can extend and take care of some of the administrative tasks so that people can actually do the
absolutely
work that they need to do.
But if you look at the example, for instance, I often like to look at other countries that have actually aged faster than we have to sort of show us a path. And Japan would be one, Italy, Germany. And so, but in Japan, you know, their birth rate makes ours look positively robust, even though we're below replacement. Secondly, their immigration, they have net out migration. So they don't have any immigration. So they have turned to 2 areas. One, setting a social expectation that people between the ages of 60 and 80 will provide care for people 80 to 120. They have a much higher lifespan than we do here. And secondly, then, they focused all their technology implementation on, all right, if 60 to 80-year-olds are going to care for people 80 to 120, then what support do we need to provide to those 60 to 80-year-olds? So, for instance, exoskeletons, body suits, because doing a lift of a person when you're 75, I know, can be much more challenging than when you're 25. So much technology, smart diapers, body suits, exoskeletons, robotics, much of that technology was originally developed in the U.S., but it was commercialized in Japan. Why? Because there was a demand for it and a need for it. And they've shown how to mass market it and use it. Now it's going to come back to us as we now are seeing demand and need for it. But again, technology and an older workforce, two key areas that Japan is way ahead of us in.
And lots of clues and cues that we can take from that.
Absolutely.
Now, I know when we were preparing for our conversation today, you had said it's not about the organizations that you founded or co-founded. It's about the work that you want to accomplish. But I do want to ask you, talk a little about the founding of NIC. What led you and your partner to do that? And the trajectory, I know that you have moved on. You're still involved, but you've moved on from that. But you know, what is the legacy there? Just talk a little about that.
Well, it really comes back, Derek, to I was first exposed to this field as a state legislator in Maryland, and that was in the early and mid-1980s. And it became clear to me then that with the aging in America, we were A, completely unprepared for it, and B, there would never be enough public sector dollars to meet all the needs just with public sector government dollars. And so that was going to mean attracting private sector dollars and investment, and that would mean educating them. And so I, together with Tony Mullen, to whom I give enormous credit, because he really came from the field, and he was also, he was also had an accountant background, and he understood numbers really well. I, on the other hand, understood social issues really well and understood communications well. Sure. And basically, the whole idea of the National Investment Center for Seniors Housing and Care was to attract private sector investment. And to do that, we had to educate them. And to educate them, we had to have the currency that they understood, which was data. And so the whole idea was to develop data that was comparable to the data these investors had for other asset types and other commercial property types, and to use that data to attract them to invest in this sector. And then my idea was then once I'd shown them the incredible market demand and opportunities for private pay senior housing and care, to then say, all right, there's another, even larger unserved market. And that's what I called the forgotten middle. Those that, put simply, were too rich to be considered poor, meaning able to qualify for government subsidy in housing or in long-term care, Medicaid, but also too poor to be considered rich, meaning they didn't have the dollars to afford private pay senior housing and care. And so, basically, then, the whole I wanted to expand, and the mission statement of NIC is to advance access and choice for older adults to different opportunities in terms of housing and care. The way to do that, NIC, was to use data to attract and educate investors to bring in private sector investment. And we started at NIC in 91, started to really had the vision for how we were going to use data. That my sort of BHAG, my big, hairy, audacious goal was in 1994. And then we launched our first, our data service in 2004. And in 2024, NCREIF, the National Council for Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries, for the first time, broke out seniors housing as a separate commercial property type that it tracked its performance. And in the first quarter of 2025, senior housing outperformed every other type of commercial property that NCREIF tracks. Again, that was a 30-year journey But now that means every investor, any investment, private equity investment fund, now has to explain why they don't have a position in seniors housing.
Brilliant.
Rather than, gee, you ought to consider it, this boutique alternative asset, as it's called. And so I'm proud of that track record. Now, as I said, we have to adjust to a new consumer, new expectations, and we have to realize that private pay senior housing and care, there's only a small percentage of the population that can afford it. And we've got to develop, just as we have workforce housing, we now have to have senior housing and care options for that same workforce cohorts, government workers, nurses, public safety folks, teachers. There are many, many people out there that we need to have real solutions for who are part of this forgotten middle.
So, have any organizations, do you think, cracked the code? Or what models? Because I know that there are, you know, certainly rentals, either in the not-for-profit or for-profit, limited service, unbundled services, you know, all of those kinds of things. But has anybody, and you don't have to name names if you don't want, but what is the model that you think comes closest to perhaps getting it right?
No one has cracked the code in a scalable way. I would say, I think the organization that's come closest is Presbyterian Homes and Services, based out of the Twin Cities. They've been doing it for a long time, more than 10 years, and they have a rigorous control on expenses so that basically they become, in a sense, more affordable, more middle market each year, because by controlling expenses, they basically... they don't have to raise their rates in the way that other market rate communities are raising them. Sure. And so they become, as I said, they become more middle market each year. And that's a rigorous control down to the penny on expenses. But it's also a really good understanding of that middle market customer will do a number of things to have a product that they like, that's affordable, that they don't feel they're going to run out of money. And so what I would say is that that becomes critical then for, is to understand that and to, so Presbyterian Homes and Services, NIC, we have a whole, a focus on this. And I am proud to say that NIC, we're not driving the creation of it, but we're publicizing models in hopes that we'll see more and more scaling. And the greatest lessons learned are, quite frankly, from workforce housing and affordable housing models. And what can we learn from that to serve the forgotten middle?
That's great. Well, I do want to ask you a bit more about Nexus Insights. But before we get there, this is a question that every Roundtable Talk guest gets. What are you looking forward to, Bob, as you age?
I think what I'm looking forward to is, as you can see, you know, I'm 75. I love what I do. I'm excited about it. It gives me a reason to get up each morning. I'm passionate about it. I feel like, I think one of the key things is I realize that experience plus knowledge can turn into wisdom. It doesn't always, but it can. And I feel like I've got a lot of experience and I've got a lot of knowledge. I have some wisdom. And that opportunity to have that perspective now, looking back, you know, I have a perspective for my wife and I, you know, in a few weeks, we'll celebrate our 54th wedding anniversary. Well, that's a perspective. I've got, you know, more than 40 years in the field. That's a perspective. And so I feel that, to me, that's exciting to be able to give back. I feel the greatest impact I've had in this field is actually mentoring the next generation, the next two generations behind me. And that's why I do a lot of teaching. And I've done a lot of a sort of what NIC calls a program I started called the Future Leaders Council. And those things excite me.
That's great. Well, you founded Nexus Insights in 2020. at a time when the pandemic was exposing major cracks in our healthcare and senior living systems. What inspired you to launch Nexus Insights?
I think it was, I launched it in the spring of 2020. So it was a moment of crisis, but also realizing that every moment of crisis is a moment of opportunity. So if there was ever a disruptive moment, I already sensed that COVID was going to, I didn't have any idea how long it would be, but it was one of those disruptive moments. And I'm a huge disciple of Clay Christensen, who we've since lost, but professor at Harvard Business School, sort of considered the father of modern thinking about innovation. And so he distinguishes between continuous innovation and disruptive innovation. Both are important. Continuous innovation, my translation, is continuing to do things better. Disruptive innovation is doing things completely differently, thinking about meeting the needs of the customer completely differently. So I was convinced in 2020 that we were at that kind of inflection point for our industry and more broadly aging services. So I brought around me a dozen folks from varying backgrounds, but all I thought the diversity of their viewpoints. Some were academics, some were researchers, some were practitioners, some were had done startups or were doing startups. But they all, some come from a public policy point of view, some from a private investment point of view. But that diversity, the whole idea of Nexus Insights was the intersection or nexus of differing ways of seeing things. And so all these people brought differing ways of seeing aging and solutions to the issues of longevity and aging well. And I'm a great believer that that kind of diversity of viewpoints with good facilitation produces exciting insights. So what the whole idea of Nexus is bringing together diverse viewpoints to then have this exciting sort of insights at the intersection of these different perspectives at this key time for thinking differently about longevity and aging. And that was one of the most fun times really in my career, is bringing this really diverse collection of folks, but who are all passionate that we've got to do things differently and we can and must. That's and so, yes, that was, and again, all these folks were doing it volunteer on top of their day jobs. So it was, but it was, and over time we built real trust in each other so that you don't have breakthroughs in new ways of thinking and new models and get it right every time. You've got to realize you've got to be able to fail fast and you've got to be able to realize you won't have 100% success rate. And what that then means is amongst our fellows, what's the comfort level and trust in one another that people would trot out their ideas and invite 11 other fellows to shoot them down, recognizing they will learn from it.
Sure, sure. You've certainly shared a lot of really interesting aspects of the organization. How would you sum up that Nexus Insights differs from other organizations working in aging and longevity?
I think that there are a lot of fantastic other organizations out there. And, you know, one of our challenges was to, as I shared with you previously, the whole idea was to have Nexus then become part of a much larger global think tank. For a number of different reasons, that didn't work out. And after 4 years, I released the fellows to go back to their day jobs. But excited with what we've accomplished and the fact that every week I probably interact with 6 to 8 of the fellows out of those 12 original fellows. So those relationships and those partnerships continue. But as Nexus Insights, I was funding it. And after 4 years, we decided, hey, we're excited with what we've accomplished. So Nexus Insights now is more my thought leadership platform to basically continue to push the whole field in such areas as we've got to focus less on what we're doing to and for and more of what we're doing with and by older adults. That older adults, we need to they need to move from what's done for them to what they learn to that they can do themselves, to then the third stage, which is what they can do for others. Because when they see what they're contributing to others, they have a reason to keep going with an excitement of, I'm making a difference. Whether I'm in a wheelchair, whether I have dementia, I am making a difference. And therefore, it gives me a sense of purpose. And as Becca Levy and her great work has done at Yale, her book, Breaking the Age Code, how your beliefs about aging determine how long and well you will live. And I'm passionate about that for myself, and I'm passionate about that for our field.
That's great. Well, your passion is definitely palpable. You mentioned that you are focusing on your own thought leadership in the field through Nexus Insights. But as the population of older adults grows, there's increasing urgency to adapt our public policies to meet their needs. How well is U.S. policy currently aligned with the needs of an aging population? You've referenced that in countries like Japan, they're further ahead in some regards. But how is our policy aligning?
We're not aligned. And I think it's a great challenge for our society. And I think it's one of the reasons why, though, it is so important that we change our narrative about older people and longevity and aging. Because we're increasingly now moving to utilitarian ethic. And as we move to a utilitarian ethic, aging services cannot say, you know, we represent, and I'm stereotyping now, but we represent old people. The moral fabric of society is demonstrated by its care for its vulnerable and its needy. Therefore, you need to provide funds for older people. That's not going to work in the future. And you don't hear people saying we invest in programs for older adults because we invest in our future. They say that about young people, about children. And I'm not disagreeing with that at all. But my point is the asset of older adults and the asset of longevity is one of the greatest gifts the 20th century has given the 21st century. But will we know how to make use of it? And will it be a longevity bonus or a longevity curse? So I don't expect all the solutions to come from the public sector or public dollars. That's not how I'm wired. That said, right now we're going the other direction.
Sure.
And whether it's reauthorization of the older adults programs and act, whether it's right now, the forgotten middle is growing bigger because fewer people are going to qualify for fewer dollars and fewer services available on housing and care for low income. At the same time, supply is not nearly what it needs to be to meet the demand of private pay senior housing and care. And with pricing power, people from the upper end are being forced into the forgotten middle. People from the lower end are being forced into the forgotten middle. The one is government policy. The other is market dynamics. But so I'm concerned the pressures that are going to be put on states in particular and also local governments to pick up the slack for older adults is going to be huge over the next 5 to 10 years. And
what responsibility do you think that they should bear?
I think I do believe that there is a responsibility at the very least for government programs to incentivize private sector participation and private sector solutions, but also to realize that at the same time, you're going to have people for whom they do need the safety net. And the safety net right now is becoming less accessible, and there are going to be less services and less dollars. And I'm most concerned about that. I think whether it's children born into poverty, or whether it's older adults who one fall or one lost job suddenly puts them into poverty. The highest rate of homelessness is amongst older, and growth is amongst older adults. And so, you know, I think there is a role for local, state, and federal government that's critical. That said, we cannot look to them to bear the sole burden of it. And that means nonprofit, fraternal, religious, charitable organizations, we need them more than ever. So it's the exact wrong time to, for instance, tax them or penalize them, because we need them to in a sense, take up the slack as particularly the federal government is pulling back. And you can't ask them to step in and then make it more expensive for them to step in.
Sure. Well said. Well said. Well, Bob, you've been incredibly generous with your time and your insights today. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed it. Your passion is definitely infectious. But I have two questions. First, what gives you the most hope about the future of aging in America?
The sheer the value of the contributions older adults want to make and are positioned to make, and I think are going to make, gives me hope. That coupled with very real society needs, for which there are few other available answers. I've mentioned the workforce, largest untapped workforce available today, as one example. I've mentioned the epidemic of loneliness amongst young people. I've mentioned moving from a fee-for-service healthcare model, which only generates volume and costs, to a value-based care model that focuses on outcomes and relative costs for those outcomes, and the key role of older adults and preventative healthcare in that, just as a few examples. So what I'm really saying, Derek, is necessity and opportunity both give me hope.
That's great. That's great. Well, again, thank you. The last question, we ask this of every Roundtable Talk guest: what have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
A sense of perspective. Perspective I have of 75, I didn't have at 55. I had even less of at 35, and I had hardly any of at 20. And I think that sense of perspective and everything from, you know, it's a perspective you learn in relationships where at age 15, the person you are convinced was your true love jilts you, or it doesn't work out, or they move away and you think your life is over. And, but it's also perspective in what's important, what counts, what's worth investing in. It's perspective in realizing that living for the moment only can actually give you fewer moments of lesser quality in the future. So I would say perspective is the thing that I lacked the most, that I feel I've been blessed to have more and more of the older that I've gotten. And that's something, we have 7 grandchildren. I am very focused on imparting to them, as I am to imparting to when I'm in the classroom.
That's great. Well, back in, I think you said 91 is when you established NIC. And, you know, what an amazing contribution you've given to our field, you and your partner at the time. And, you know, so while you probably didn't have the perspective, and you could maybe argue whether or not you had the vision, you certainly did create the foundation for something really important.
Well, I thank you for that. I'm excited to see how far we've come, as we've talked about now over this show, over our conversation. We still have a long ways to go, but we're better positioned certainly than we were in 1991 when we started NIC, and that does encourage me. And as I said, you know, my capstone project at NIC was the research to identify and name the group, the forgotten middle, and identify the need and opportunity of serving that. I would say my personal capstone project, though, is every young person I've mentored in the field over the course of now the 35 years, specifically working within the field and with NIC. And that, to me, every course I've taught, every lecture I've given, and many of those people are becoming the CEOs of organizations in our field, and they will be disruptive leaders for the 21st century. And I'm proud of that. And I'm one of the people on whose shoulders they stand. That's great. And I hope each one of them will be conscious of at least 10 people who will say, I stand on your shoulders.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, again, Kent, thank you enough for the time, the wisdom and the perspectives that you've shared with us today. So thank you, Bob. And I'd also like to thank you for tuning in, and also to our producer, Dave Schaffner, our engineer, Matt Campbell. I'm Derek Dunham. Until next time, thanks for listening to Roundtable Talk.